Welcome to the Tailored Life Podcast. This is a podcast for average individuals who want to achieve above average results and live above average lives. And on the show today, we have two average individuals who strive to know more than the average individual and do above average things and live above average lives while getting above average results. So I have the one and only B. Rob, Dr. Brandon Roberts, our Chief Science Officer at Tailored Coaching Method. It's been a while, but we need to bring him on for somewhat of a research roundup, I guess you could call it. And we're going to dive into some different topics today. We might not get into all the topics as we were just discussing, because sometimes we get into these and it takes way longer to cover than we expected. But we are going to start with food addiction, and then we're going to dive into low energy availability, which are two topics that I think are very, I don't know if misleading is the right word, but not a lot of people truly understand what they are when, most people think food addiction, they're like processed sugar and that's all they think about. It's like sugar's addicting. Low energy availability is a very, very serious thing, but a lot of times people don't understand what it takes to actually get there. However, some people are so ignorant and stubborn in their pursuits that they get there and they try to ignore that they're there. So it's a really important thing to talk about. And if we have enough time, we're going to dive into some latest research on creatine and collagen. But if we don't get there, we're just going to record another episode with Brandon very soon, and we'll dive into those as well. So, Brandon, thank you for coming on, man. I'm excited to finally get back into the podcast game with you.
Yeah, no, it's good to be back. I was thinking of there's a rap song with the line when you said above average, it's no mediocre. We don't do that here. So,
God, what song is
that? Yeah, it's definitely good to be. I don't know. It's driving me insane. I almost Googled it while you're introing.
It is a good one. I know exactly what you're talking about. It's funny. I've often said, it's like when people ask, clients, like, what do you say when somebody's giving you crap for, you know, eating us out or diet or whatever? And I'll be like, what you eat doesn't make me shit. And like, they like laugh and they're like, oh, that's funny. And I'm like, no, it really is like a really good piece of advice. And it's from a Jay-Z song. Like literally it's where I actually heard it. And ever since on Reasonable Doubt, which is like his first album, great album. But, I've always used that advice for fat loss clients, even though it came from Jay-Z. So anyway, food addiction, man. We're going to dive into this. You've been, I want to commend you for this too, actually. You've been back on the Instagram game strong. I feel like you were pretty busy for a while there and you kind of disappeared. And then all of a sudden it was like, boom. When I went to go study up on some things before this podcast, I was like, wow, he's actually posted a ton of these infographics on these topics. Insane.
Yeah. It's I think I took like a year hiatus, like almost exactly a year. And I was like, all right, like it helps me. Sometimes I forget, like, yes, it takes time to read a study and make infograph and they're not super complex, but it helps me to like keep up with the literature and then also kind of expand some of these niche topics. So like food addiction is one where, I've never done any food addiction research, so I wouldn't consider myself like a super expert, but like I can read the 15 papers out there on it pretty quickly and kind of make a decent narrative so people can understand A, where to get the information, but B, what's the general consensus right now.
Right. Yeah. So I'm going to link Brandon's Instagram in the description so you guys can go check that out. I believe it is B_Rob21, right?
Yeah, B_Rob21. Yeah.
Okay, B_Rob_21. I'll put that in the description so you guys go follow him. A lot of really good science-based information, and it's communicated well or interpreted well, because that's a skill in itself, as we've talked about many times on the podcast, interpreting research properly. So let's dive into food addiction, man. Why don't you start by actually, most people would probably roll their eyes and be like, well, obviously it's just being addicted to food, but give us the science-y definition. What does it really mean? What is food addiction?
Yeah, so this is probably like diving straight in. There is no technical definition of food addiction, right? So if you go to the doctor and they want to diagnose you with food addiction, just like they would diagnose you with, you know, cancer or something else. Like if you look in the regulations and the books, there's no clear definition. But what the literature right now kind of says is it's a condition where people compulsively eat in like a reward seeking behavior, despite knowing that, hey, if I eat all this food, it's bad for me. I'm just doing it because I'm seeking that reward. So that's the simple definition of it.
Okay. So it's basically with food addiction, it's not necessarily, I guess we'll get into this. I was going to say, it's not necessarily like a literal addiction, like, Well, maybe it is. Like when I think of like addiction, I always cigarettes always comes to mind. You're addicted to cigarettes, right? Or any type of drug, I guess. But if we think of that and there is a like a dopamine or a fix, that is a technically it's a reward system in the brain. So it's essentially banking on the same exact type of physiological process. Is that would that be right?
Yeah, and so some of the early research was doing just that. They would like put people in an MRI scanner so it can like see your brain light up. And then like they'd have them eat some kind of like highly addictive food, like the highly palatable, high fat, high sugar types of stuff. Put them in there and see how their brain reacted. And there's a couple studies I think now that show there's a similar reaction in the brain, but it is from that like reward mechanism. Right, it's that dopamine hit. There's a couple other transmitters in there too, but for the most part, yeah, I think that's a great comparison. Where like you go to smoke, it's like a dopamine hit. Gamblers have the same thing where they go to gamble and they get that high. That's the idea kind of behind it.
One thing I've never understood, and this is kind of unrelated, and I don't know if you know the research on this, the runner's high. And people often say it, and I know it's, but I always think about that, and I'm like, well, I understand I don't smoke cigarettes, I don't do drugs, I don't have a food addiction, but I understand just from not even being addicted, but I understand from partying and eating in the past and stuff when I'd have like I'd deprive myself and have a cheat day. And like we've all gone through those stages as fitness professionals, I'm sure. But I know I can relate to the feeling of like an instant gratification because of that dopamine fix. I understand that. But a runner's high, I'm like, you've been running for 4 hours straight. Does the high just keep going? How do you get that hit? How is that? Does that, I mean, you're exhausted, you're just keep
Yeah,
on running.
I will admit I have no idea. And like I've tried to reach this runner's high and I've never reached it. Like I'm not a runner by any means, but like I get like 10 or 12 miles in, and I'm just like, there should be a high somewhere in here, and there's definitely just a low. There's just a lot of low right now.
Still not high, guys.
Yeah, just
I'm
keep
on
running.
mile 12. Yeah, I did the longest run I've done. I mean, since maybe when I was a kid in soccer, which I don't recall, but it was 40 minutes. I think it was, I don't even know how many miles it was. Honestly, I was running with my buddy Cody, and he was like, "You're going with me." And we were in Texas, but like I had nothing else to do. I was like, "All right, man, I guess I'm going." And yeah, no high. I was so thankful we were back at the Airbnb by the time it was over. I was like, "I'm done."
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so this reward center in the brain, and it lights up similar to like smoking and all these kind of things. Now, can you explain more of these like the neurological connections? Is it just dopamine? Is it lights up no matter what they eat? Is there any type of emotional connection? Is there anything going on inside the brain that is like lasting effects? I know with the book, like The Hungry Brain, for example, it seemed like there was a lot going on that ended up triggering leptin and ghrelin, all these other components of hormones.
Yeah, so it's kind of with the food addiction side of it or the food response, measuring stuff in the brain is pretty hard, right? You can't like take a piece of brain out and you can't really take fluid out. But the images kind of show the amygdala light up in kind of anticipation of food. So that would suggest that that area is being activated by some neurotransmitters. And I don't like have all of the exact neurotransmitters that are elevated, like dopamine's one of them, acetylcholine's probably up. There's a probably glutamate is probably up too. But it's pretty like clear. Like I have a nice image on my Instagram. If you look at it, you're like, oh no, that's definitely elevated just looking at the MRI. So
Now, is there, did they do any studies where like they, for lack of better terms, tease them? Like they show the food or they anticipate the food that maybe the participant in the study believes they're going to get the food. So this starts to light up and then they don't actually get the food.
yeah, so that's actually what this Gerhardt 2011, and she's one of like the premier food addiction researchers. She has this like long line of research. Obviously, it's been 20 something years, but that's what they kind of did was they had these chocolate milkshakes, and they told people they were going to give them to them, took a scan, and then gave them the milkshake and took another scan, and that's how you could see in the and. Before they even received the milkshake, the area would light up, and then after they received it, it would like stay lit up and go more intense, which kind of means that the area is more activated.
Did they take it away to any of them? Like not like show them and tell them they're gonna give it to them and then not give it to
Like, here you go, take it back.
them?
I know they didn't do that, and they might have in later studies, but the one I'm referring to, the 2011 one, is just pretty straightforward. So
So the reason I ask is there's some studies that kind of display the anticipation of fear as a way to train the brain in certain ways. And there's even stuff on like mice, right? Like they have studies where they there's a maze and there, or there's like a chute, you know, there's like one path basically. And then there's like the cheese and it's like sprints for the cheese. And then there's the cheese and then there's a cat. And you can get the cheese, but you're going to get the cat's going to get you, or you can run kind of thing, right? And so like it will remove its it'll like basically ignore its temptation because the fear outweighs the temptation. The reason I ask is because it's almost like I gotta imagine that the best way to control temptation is to is kind of that. It's to either have something, it's to force yourself into not acting upon the temptation or having something that outweighs the sensation of that temptation, which could be fear. So maybe like, I mean, there's no way they're not gonna put like a milkshake here and then a lion here. And it's like, okay, which one do you want, buddy? But like, you know, if you think of health consequences and scary, like, I don't know, like I'm just thinking out loud. 'Cause it's, I think there's so much that goes on the brain that fascinates me in fear and temptation, discipline. All these ones are one of them. And a lot of it is anticipation, even with discipline or taking risks or anything. It's more scary to consider the risk or to see what you have to be disciplined for than to actually just do it, right? Like an ice bath. I actually didn't mind the ice bath that I've only done it once, but it wasn't like the end of the world. But man, the 5 minutes where I was waiting in line after all these guys at this event, I was just like, I was shaking. I was just angry. And then I was sad. And then I was scared. And then I was like trying to talk to myself. Like, and then I get in and I was like, I crushed that. It wasn't that bad. Like, you know what I mean? So,
Yeah.
yeah, I don't know if there's anything on that side of food addiction that I think that, or if it's just like all the studies, they just literally give it to them.
Yeah, I haven't seen any anything more at like anticipatory or take back than the Curhart 11 study. But I do think it's interesting how they kind of segueing a little bit, how they measure it in terms of like, how do you know you have food addiction? And again, it's not a bona fide diagnosis yet, but if you look at the Yale Food Addiction Scale, so you can like literally Google it and it's free, you can pull it up and take it. There's questions, there's like a list of 13 questions, and then you mark how many times you felt that way during the last year, which is a long time. So some of the questions are like, you know, I ate once to the point where I felt physically ill, right? So that's occasionally we do that, you know. There's one question that says, I avoided work, school, or social activities because I was afraid I would overeat. Well, like if I'm in prep, I'm probably doing that. And then there's, you know, there's a set of questions of standardized questions that really help you understand how you interact with food on a lot of different levels. And so the researchers have used this scale to do pretty much all of their research, whereas they developed it or they validated it, and then they've gone on to say, okay, in this population, you know, if we do something, do you consider that food addiction or do you not? So I would encourage people to kind of look at it and just be like, okay, just get an idea of what food addiction is, a better idea that is. And take the, it's like a quiz. We should make it into like a quiz or something. Just so you get a better context for it.
I think that it's also one of those things where, 'cause like the first question, I've definitely overate to that point of being sick. I have probably avoided events in the past, like on my last prep. But then I always like, so, and this is where I think it could change too. I don't know if I've ever had, like, when I'm in prep, I'm doing it for a sport and I'm pretty disciplined. I'm excited about it. So for me, it's less of a fear of overeating and more of a fear of judgment, right? Where like now it's totally different. Like now, and this doesn't apply to anybody listening, so I'm sorry, but like, unless, I mean, it could, if you own a business like I do, you could. But like now it's so commonplace. People know what I do and it's established company. So like if I go to a barbecue, even in my cul-de-sac in my neighborhood, and I don't touch anything, and somebody's like, oh, you're not gonna eat? And I'm like, oh yeah, no, I'm prepping for something. They're just gonna be like, oh, totally get it, whatever. Like, because they know that I'm probably doing something that has to pertain to fitness. And guess what? That's how I pay my mortgage. So, you know what I mean? It is what it is. Now, they don't realize that I'm actually going to lose a bunch of money bodybuilding because I got to pay for a coach and I got to pay for posing and I got to pay for tanning. I got to pay for a hotel. I got to pay for the competition. I got to pay for my swim shorts. Like, so I don't make any money on that. But point being is that I think like that's also a very common thing for people, though. They might not even worry about overeating, but they might worry about judgment. Which I don't know if that would, that's probably not food addiction. That's probably more or less just some kind of disordered eating. I don't want to say I have disordered eating, but maybe.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I think that's, there's components of that behavioral relationship with food that are hard to define unless you get a lot of the really concrete examples in a row. So, you know, I'm looking at this, I pulled up the scale. So one of the questions, and this is like the last question on there, is like, my friends or family were worried about how much I overate. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, I don't think I've ever had a friend or family worry about how much I overate. Most of them just worry that I'm not eating enough. Mm-hmm. You know, independent of prep, it's like, you know, you go home, you see your family, see your friends, you're like, hey, you're not eating very much. I'm like, actually, this is exactly how much I'm supposed to be eating. But yes, I'm glad you're paying attention.
Yeah. So would this would probably be a good way to determine the difference between a food addiction and maybe those who just, they suffer from like binge eating disorder, where they're chronically dieting, maybe they're not, it's not chronically dieting, but they're routinely in a diet. And every once in a while they have these episodes where they binge eat and they overeat tremendously, but it's very rare that people have a worry, like your family doesn't worry about you overeating all the time, because it's usually in private. It's usually hidden. Sometimes it leads to other things like bulimia or whatever it may be, or forms of, you know, depriving yourself even more so to quote unquote recover from it. Is this the biggest difference? Is like maybe these binge eating disorders are more in dieters, bodybuilders, physique athletes, people like that, models, whatever it may be, versus maybe obese individuals are more commonly associated with actual food addiction?
Yeah, I think that's part of it. There's also like a stigma, right? I mean, if you talk to some of our clients or, you know, people who are overweight or obese and they go into the doctor's office, they get treated like sometimes poorly, sometimes really well to visit the doctor. But there is like a, hey, you're, you know, I know you think you have a problem, but really you just need to eat less, right? And it's like, well, maybe that's not it. Not saying everyone has food addiction or an eating disorder, but like, people are different and you have to treat the symptoms, not necessarily the like visual appearance of someone. I think another good one on here is, and I think I can say this one cause I could super relate to it, is eating the same amount of food did not give me as much enjoyment as it used to. Mm. Right. After that first, like 3 bites of ice cream, the enjoyment's not as high. I'll tell you that, but I still eat it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think that's the hard part too, is like, cause I do that for sure. Like, you know, if I'm like, if I sit down, man, you know what, this might be on there. Something that I've caught myself doing. And, is this with like alcohol, like my wife can drink, pour a glass of wine. She'll have like half a glass maybe. And she's like, do you want something? No, I'm good. And then come Saturday. And then I'm like, I'll get like 6-pack or whatever. And I feel like I got to finish it all, right? Or like I got to, like, if I'm going to put this in my calories, I'm going to make the most of it, you know? And, or like even looking at somebody like, I don't want to waste my calories on this. And then you go, ooh, okay. Like that's where it starts to maybe tiptoe on it. Cause you're just like overanalyzing things too much. Again, if you have goals, I don't think it's a bad thing. If this is like you dieted a year ago, you got to your goal, and you're still doing this kind of stuff and you never have any off time, it's, I think that's where there's a big difference of like, and this is, again, that's not even food addiction. That's eating. That's more disordered eating, not eating disorder, but disordered eating. And so I do want to ask though, with food addiction specifically, is it more, like triggered by emotions, triggered by some kind of psychological disorder? Because I'm like, is it because people are sad or emotional? Is it because somebody has like maybe some wiring in their brains a little off, in, you know, whether it's dopamine or it's stress that's causing things, or like they just have like an angry tick and it, that's their sedation tool? Or is it specifically related to the type of foods they're eating, you know?
Yeah. So I think that's one of the things they're trying to tease out is There's always going to be a behavioral component to eating. Like, it's just what we do in society. We eat together, you know, growing up, you always, even if you didn't eat around the family, people, you see people eat together. And that plays a role. And there's even some, like, I won't say trauma, but some good and bad relationships with food that can be established early on in life that you may not even realize you had. Like, your favorite food could be associated with some, like, event or set of events that you really enjoyed, like during your birthdays. Maybe you love pizza because, like, every time you had pizza, it was like awesome, right? And so now you love pizza. So I don't think it's not purely behavioral. It's not purely that your like food addiction per se is that you're overweight or obese, and it's not purely because of like the way that the food makes you feel or like changes your brain chemistry. It's a combination of all of them. And so they haven't teased out which one contributes the most, or if it's even across the board, or if there's something we can do to like change it.
Is there any solutions that they studied? Like, was is it just like general practices and recommendations for these people?
Yeah, so right now it's more just, it's so controversial whether it even exists or not. Like, you have, like, in science, often this happens where you have two camps, one that says this thing happens this way, and one that says, no, it doesn't happen that way, it happens this way, or it doesn't happen at all. And I think that's in the science realm, that's where we're at right now. Is they've developed scales, they've kind of shown concept, a consistent concept, and now they're looking at, you know, is it the highly palatable foods, high fat, high sugar, or is it, you know, high sugar? Because, you know, throughout the past even 20 years, we've gone through like sugar is really bad. No, high fat is really bad. And it's really like, okay, all of it can be bad or good, context dependent. But it's what we call more of a characterization of the science behind food addiction right now. So there's no interventions. I mean, I'm sure there's some pilot data out there somewhere. But there's no intervention that I've seen or study that I've seen that says, hey, you're food addicted based on this scale. And now we're going to try to intervene and do something so you're no longer food addicted. That study is probably like literally happening right now, but I did not come across anything published like that.
Well, and I don't, I mean, obviously, this is just my opinion, but I don't see how anybody can say that it can't exist or it doesn't exist. Because if you really think about it, I mean, there's a very, it's very, very common in today's world. There's porn addiction, right? And that would be like me saying, that doesn't exist. That's impossible. It's like, no, there's people who are definitely addicted to porn. And it makes sense. The dopamine hit, the false reality, like, it's very common. It makes sense. But just because I don't get the same feeling from food as somebody else and I don't feel addicted to it, who am I to say that somebody can't be addicted? You can probably be addicted to literally anything that provides you the sensation and reward of the reward center in your brain, right? I mean, why not?
I mean, that's like you said, you can be addicted to video games, you can be addicted to exercise, you can be addicted to all kinds of stuff. But to give some more like context, so according to the scale that we kind of went through a couple questions, there's a bunch more. That scale, the general population is like 5% of them that they've tested so far are like food addicted. So it's pretty low. When you look at like obese people only, the percentage raises a little bit, so it's like 15 to 20% of obese people will be addicted to food based on that scale. And then when you go to severe obesity, you know, you're talking like BMI of over like 35 or like BMI of 40, like large people. That's more like 40 to 50% present with those symptoms of food addiction, or like a lot of those were behavioral associations with food, or like things that are just you just look at the scale and you're like, yeah, okay, if I scored high on everything here, I could tell that I probably have some kind of food eating disorder. And if it's now called food addiction, great. Now I can move on and try to figure out how to fix it. But again, that's also with the line of binge eating, right? So like you mentioned, like if you're food addicted, you probably also binge eat just because you like the taste of food and it gives you a reward and stuff. So to tease those two out is also something else that we kind of really have to figure out. But I just wanted to throw out some context of like average person, maybe 5 out of 100 people
Yeah.
are addicted to food.
I would also say that the obese individual who has potentially has food addiction is probably actually less likely to have binging episodes. It's probably more of they're just constantly eating. Those are the, and typically, I haven't done as much research on this as you, but I even remember watching some of this stuff in school with documentaries and just unhealthy, quote unquote, individuals. And this is where they have like snacks and candy in their center console. Then they get to work and they have stuff in their desk and they're just constantly eating throughout the day. And it's usually highly processed foods. I think there's a lot of people and maybe research that would point it to emotional trauma, PTSD, like stress. There's a lot of things that might trigger it to begin with, and then it kind of gets out of hand over time. So maybe something that sparks the fire might be emotional, but the thing that keeps them hooked is the highly palatable foods per se. But if you think of binge, most people who binge eat, although it can definitely be with highly palatable foods, to me, it's very, I wouldn't assume somebody's food addicted if they can deprive themselves for a prolonged period of time before that binge, which is usually what happens. Whether it's a week or a month, usually they're not eating for a while and then it causes that. So it's like the deprivation is what causes the binging. And they'll binge on fucking rice cakes. You know what I mean? Like I've had clients that are like, I don't even know why I ate an extra like half cup of plain oats with no flavor. And I'm like, yeah, it doesn't sound appetizing at all, but clearly you need a diet break, right? And so sometimes we it's like it's comical, they can laugh, but then there's other times where people, I haven't experienced this with clients because I don't specialize in this, but I've heard people go way out of hand. You know, even after a competition prep, they're just eating way too many sweet potatoes and veggies and fruit and like just really healthy foods. But it's because they deprive themselves for so long, they binge on anything. And usually once they recover, it seems like they can more easily recover. Whereas like a food addiction, somebody's 300 plus pounds and can't stop eating because it's all everywhere. And they're now normal food tastes very plain and bland and gross. And you know what I mean? So to me, like that's, and although in the research, I'm sure there's plenty of links where they're closely tied, but that's where I would see the separation. One question I would have for you, and this might just be more on your thoughts based on what you've read into, but a common thing I hear with like flexible dieting is people who maybe present more of the symptoms or habitual traits of food addiction or binge eating or anything can be kind of worried about flexible dieting and fearful of tracking macros and stuff because you can technically fit anything you want in there and then they know that can get out of hand. And that's a sign, obviously, based on that scale, like you fear overeating, right? And then if you talk to people who use flexible dieting, or even myself, who I've actually helped people who had that fear control it. Maybe they didn't have full-blown food addiction, but control it and actually learn how to manage and just like eat a little bit of something and not like feel like you have to eat the whole thing or eat all the Oreos, just have a couple, because it gave us a point system and a budget system with macros that allowed them to actually, hey, this isn't cheating on my diet. This isn't unhealthy if I have it in moderation. But you see that argument all the time, you know? So I guess my question is, where do you stand on that aspect? And what do you think, maybe those who have food addiction really wouldn't work well with that because it's teasing them versus those who do work well with tracking macros don't actually have the food addiction. They just didn't know how to manage things properly.
Yeah, so I think even in my coaching experience, you're right. There is something to like figuring out how and what to eat and when, right? So if we have flexible dieters, I think I doubt many people who are flexible dieters just because of the inherent like consciousness of food would fall into this food addictive category. Like that's probably not, there's probably not so much overlap there. Maybe some other disorders, but I wouldn't think that food addiction would be one of them. But what flexible dieting really does, and I think almost everyone who's like been in fitness for a while or like has competed or like takes their physique seriously has probably used flexible dieting for some period of time and thought it was like the coolest thing ever, right? Like I definitely did it for probably a year or two and was like, I can eat whatever I want. And then you go for on for a little while and you're like, actually, this isn't, if I do this to an extreme, if I min-max this, like it's not gonna work well for me and my body. Yes, I can do it. Yes, there's probably some other food associations driving the fact that I want 7 Pop-Tarts, but I over time learned that it's a tool. I know what food to eat, when, how much, and then I can kind of limit that those overeating areas or monitor. Even like I tell, clients all the time, like change your environment to what you want it to be, and it'll really help you succeed, right? So if that means not having many sweets in your house, then do that. But it took me a long time to figure that out, longer than probably most people. A couple years of doing this is a while.
I would say that might even be, again, I think like when I think of this stuff too, I don't always think of like full-blown food addiction, but maybe you have to just overlook what you're doing a little bit, right? And so like, for example, you said you don't have to have the sweets out in there. Like, get rid of them. If somebody puts up a fight with that, I'm like, okay, that's not a good sign. If you really you're fighting for those, or if somebody eats a little bit, someone like, just throw the rest of it. Like, okay, it's you bought something, you had a little bit because it was like this date night or whatever, throw the rest away. And they like have a really big issue with throwing food away. It's like, hey, unless you're gonna ship it off to a third world country and donate food, like just throw it away because it doesn't matter. You can put it in your body or you can throw it away. It's not that big of a deal, you know? And so if they put up a fight with those things, I'm kind of like, hey, this isn't a full-blown red flag, but check yourself. Like we gotta, it's just food.
And I used to have that thought where like, we were relatively poor growing up, so it was like you ate all the food on your plate or you got in trouble, right? And that I love my parents, but man, I was there's some like deep ingrained something there where it's like, yes, I had to figure out how to solve the problem of you don't have to eat all those fries. You don't actually need them all. Like you're good, just throw them away. And so, even to the day, I still like sometimes I'm like, I just tell my wife, be like, just go throw these away now, please. Please just go throw them away.
100%. And that's a really common one, actually. A lot of people were raised that way. I think it's a little bit different now, you know. I was talking about this the other day. I think it might have been on the podcast. Maybe it was with somebody, but it's something I've noticed with my daughter that it makes me really happy is she's so like we'll be out and she wants to get candy or something like that, and she'll have some, and she rarely finishes it all because she knows when she's had what she wants, and she'll even literally say like, "I don't want a tummy ache," and I'm like, "Wow, okay." When I was your age, I was a chubby kid. I'd be like, "I'm eating mine and my brother's." Like I'm going in, but like it's really cool to see because we didn't necessarily do anything. We just didn't apply pressure to food. We just have never, you know, applied pressure to food at all. And it helps a lot. But okay, so food addiction as a whole, is there any like I guess the only last thing that we didn't really answer is specific foods. I mean, you mentioned highly palatable foods, but is there anything more on the specific foods that you want to mention or say about that maybe they think might be causing some of this food addiction?
So a lot of the research is based around ultra processed fruit foods, so like your chips, your candy, your like popcorn and stuff like that, stuff that obviously just tastes really good. There aren't any studies on what you mentioned earlier was like just eating oatmeal. Like that's not something most people are worried about, but that does probably need to be figured out of, hey, we're doing the research now. We see a link between food addiction and these highly processed, oh, high fat, high sugar foods, and that's the most likely place we're going to find it. So let's start there, right? And that's where they're at. Even in 2022, there's a couple papers that came out looking at, hey, can highly processed foods meet the criteria to be labeled as addictive substances, right? That would be huge if like some just like your cigarette label comes on, it's like highly addictive substance. Like that from a regulation standpoint, that's a big deal. And so that's what they're kind of looking at. There's also the idea that some of these foods are really cheap and easy, right? So if it's cheap and easy, and especially compared to fruit or something that may be more nutritious, independent of calories, that's probably not good from a food addictive standpoint too. So that's another area they're focusing on is ultra profit process, cheap, easy, accessible marketing, right? Marketing is huge. And we know that. So socially acceptance is another one where they're like, hey, is it socially acceptable for me to have this bag of chips versus having this apple? Well, we had to kind of tease that out and figure out what role food selection plays in food addiction. So there's a lot to be done. I think to kind of wrap it up nicely, and then I'll leave it to you for any last comments. The main thing I wanted to get across was there's this growing body of research on food addiction. It's not necessarily defined in the DSM-5, which is like the diagnostic manual, but it is being more developed. And it hasn't been validated everywhere, but if you just think about how people are reacting to food and look at some of the research, it's like, yeah, I think food addiction is a thing, and we're going to need to really start to address that with people who have it. And those let people are more likely to be severely obese and highly, overweight.
I love it, man. I don't think there's anything to add. I think it would be really cool if they did add that to the labels. It sounds extreme, but I do think it can only be a positive thing, at the end of the day. And even the social aspect, I think that's like really that's marketing, that's commercials, that's TV shows, it's what you see. Like if it becomes more socially acceptable to hold a bag of chips instead of an apple, that's probably ass backwards and kind of weird. Like we should be starting to work on reversing that narrative, but no, I think that's perfect, man. We can move on to the next subject, which will be the last one for this podcast, and that's the low energy availability. So this is I would say low energy availability, metabolic adaptation, REDS, which I believe is relative energy deficit syndrome in sport, right? They're all kind of commonly associated. The female athlete triad, which I believe is a little bit of this, as well as amenorrhea, which is the loss of a period. So there's a lot of different things that happen when we essentially eat too little for too long of a period of time. However, I think this is a good topic simply because there's a few things. One, there's a lot of people who underestimate how low their calories have to go to lose weight, because there's a lot of research on fat loss, and a lot of it shows 25, 35, even upwards of 65% calorie deficits to accomplish the result. So when we consider a 5 to 10% deficit and we're not seeing results and we're frustrated, you gotta understand it does require a lot. So I think it's important for us to understand this because I think sometimes the misunderstanding of what low energy availability is or REDS or anything like that, metabolic adaptation, causes people to be afraid to go into a large enough deficit to actually lose weight as a general person trying to accomplish fat loss. Whereas I believe this is more along the lines of maybe I go into a chronic diet and I just don't get out of it and I'm too lean and I'm dieting too much and I don't have much fat to lose. Now we're going to start having some serious consequences over time, but I don't know if it applies to the everyday person who just wants to lose fat, especially not in the beginning of their diet. And I may be wrong, and you're going to tell me if I am, but I want to dive into this because I think this is a good topic for people to understand really what's going on. So why don't you first start with the definition? So what is low energy availability?
Yeah, so it's basically a state where the energy, the calories you're eating can't meet the basic demands of your body functions, so like your basal metabolic rate plus your exercise that you're doing. So if you think about this as an equation, energy availability equals daily energy intake minus daily exercise energy expenditure over fat-free mass. And fat-free mass matters here because that's metabolically active tissue. Your fat doesn't really burn that much calories, but it also doesn't need much calories. Whereas, your organs, your muscle, your brain, they all need a lot of calories. So when you get that equation, I said, under 30 calories per kilo of fat-free mass, that's what you would consider low energy availability.
Okay.
Yeah. So under 30 calories per kilogram of fat-free mass per day.
How much of this is predictive on your body stores, like the calories stored as body fat or glycogen or liver glycogen? And the reason I ask that is because, so for example, if somebody thinks they fit this category because they're on chronic low, they're really low calories, they have fat, a good amount of fat-free mass, but they also have 40 pounds of fat to lose. Like, at what point does the table turn? Because I think that's probably the part that needs to that would make it confusing. Because it's I gotta imagine there. Even if somebody has a good amount of fat-free mass, they also have to have a lower amount of body fat tissue on their body as well, right?
Yeah, and that's why it's in like basically it takes away the whole body fat component, where you're just dividing by fat-free mass. So you could have like Yes, you could have a ton of fat mass, but realistically, if you have a ton of fat mass and you're low energy available, it's fairly uncommon, but you could have some of the same symptoms. But you remember the top part of the equation is exercise energy expenditure. It's so you really have to focus on that part, and that's where LEA kind of has honed in, where it's okay, not only am I not eating lunch, and maybe I don't have much fat-free mass, so muscle mass, we'll call it, but now I'm doing all of this exercise, right? And generally this started with lean runners. So think of how much mileage runners do. Think of these like dual sport athletes who run and cycle and swim and do all kinds of stuff, and just how much energy they expend. We talked about like a 12-mile run earlier, right? Like that's like 1,000 calories. So if you're not doing some of that weekend warrior plus stuff, then this probably doesn't apply to you.
Yeah, that's good context too. And I think, 'cause I even think about there was that guy who like fasted for a full year. I mean, he lost over like 100 pounds, but like he had like vitamin IV and water. So it's not like he was just nothing, but he went that long. So like my question is, for somebody like that, do they ever experience low energy availability? Because their body, obviously, I guess like, if I'm not eating, but my body has fat stored, can it supply me with the calories needed per kilo of fat-free mass to make sure that my bodily functions that are necessary for surviving can still go on? Does that make sense?
And it does. And I think because of the research is so focused in athletes, I don't know that anybody's intentionally put someone who is overweight or obese in a purposeful LEA position and then measured things just to look at LEA. Like, and yes, there are studies who say, all right, you're an overweight woman, you're mid-40s, we're going to put you on a low-calorie diet at 600 calories. Okay, so if they have much muscle mass at all, which these studies, the women don't, but if they did, they would automatically be in an LEA state. And they would probably see some hormonal fluctuations, and they would probably see some reduced energy and some fatigue, but nobody's really looked at it from that angle yet. So I think there's things we're like touching on around the fact that, you're probably not eating as low calories as you need to diet sometimes, but also just because you're eating 1,000 calories or 1,200 calories doesn't mean you are in low energy availability, especially if you don't have much muscle.
I don't think they looked at it from this lens, but I think the closest thing would probably have been the Biggest Loser, right? Because that's the only scenario I can think of, which I do think they have a Biggest Loser study too, but like where they exercised that much and dieted. Most studies, they don't exercise that much on top of the diet.
Right. And if you look at like their health markers from that's a perfect example. If you look at their health markers, they're better, right? They're like glucose control is better, their lipids are better, everything's better because they're losing all of that weight. So yes, they may have some like hormonal changes. I don't recall the women how their estrogen changed, but the men probably lost like had lower testosterone because they were doing so much energy and not eating much. But that's a great example of like those people actually got healthier, like on a blood work and by a doctor, like mentally, probably not, but like physically, they were healthier once they recovered a little bit at the end.
Is there any research pointing towards like when the cutoff for health is? I mean, like we all know, like, hey, like if you're really overweight and you're in a severe deficit, you're exercising, like you said, you're losing body fat, even if you're not getting as many nutrients in, you're going to continually get healthier as you lose body fat. And then on the flip side, we all know that when you're bodybuilding, there's a certain point where you're just not healthy anymore. Like, you know, and so like speaking from experience right now, because I'm in prep, I'm 5 weeks out from my first show, I'm like, at what point do I become not very healthy anymore? You know, it's like, is there a actual marker of general health? Because like I can tell you, I mean, I take vitamins, I eat really good foods, like I'm pretty good about that stuff. But I know exactly when the switch flips from like a fatigue perspective. And it was honestly like this week, like on Monday, it was like, okay. it's finally hitting me. Like I'm starting to, my cheeks are starting to sink in a little bit. I'm starting to feel a little tired, but is there a cutoff point where it goes from losing weight is healthy to no more?
Yeah. So I think there's not like a clear, like, hey, this is the cutoff point, like public health knowledge type stuff. Mm-hmm. But if you look at kind of the bodybuilding, the physique literature, it happens around 8% body fat, like a true 6 to 8%. And chronic dieting, we'll call chronic anything more than like, I don't know, 10 weeks or so. So yes, but there's not a whole lot on it.
And what's that in women?
In fact, if you look at
8% men is what?
It would probably be like 16-ish% okay. in women. Like a healthy female athlete, and I don't work with near as many women as I do men, I'll point that out, is like ranges between 20 and 23% depending mm-hmm. on the sport.
That's right.
You know, when you start dropping down, you know, it gets pretty dicey pretty quick for females because you have like the amenorrhea and the, you know, potential bone loss and fatigue, and then your injury rate jumps. It's a little bit more safe for men. So that's what, again, when we look back at the original research on Reds and LEA and the triad, it's all on women because they have such a terrible, terrible time when this stuff happens.
Yeah. Okay. Now, I know that it sounds like women is the answer, especially with Reds and the female triad, and knowing that we have to worry about amenorrhea and such. So my next question was, who is this most common in? So this can go gender, obviously, but also maybe age ranges. Is there a certain, like maybe a certain, like younger is more resilient than older? And if there's, you mentioned sports quite a bit. Is there certain sports that are more prone to this?
Yeah, so most common in your long distance runners, males and females, but mostly females. Like there's a slight edge there. I would say outside of that, age, just because of like lifestyle, probably like 20 to 35 or 40 max, probably like 35. Again, thinking more like true athletes that are like competing for decent levels of competition, not like you're a weekend warrior or something. This is like, hey, I'm a college track athlete, or I'm a college endurance athlete, or, you know, I'm an Ironman, like, and I place well. So more of those populations are more prone to it. Obviously there's plenty of studies in bodybuilders who, if you go back and you like, there's a good review on this, actually, if you calculate all their energy availability, it's very low. It's like less than 25, which is below that 30 calorie threshold. And they're in that for like long periods, like 6 to 10 weeks after, like they're halfway mark in their prep, and then they're just in it. So that probably happens in females too, gotta assume. And so those two types of populations are the ones that I see the most and are studied the most too.
Okay. This might be, I mean, you kind of answered some of these ones already, but as far as metabolic and hormonal adaptations that can occur from this, I mean, it's obvious, right? Losing your period. I'm assuming just obviously if you lose weight, especially if you lose lean mass, if there's any hormonal downregulation that causes metabolic slowdown, be that thyroid or whatever else, that's going to cause metabolic adaptation, obviously. Is it basically low energy availability is officially happening when you see hormonal adaptations, or and then when you do those, how reversible are those? Like, can you actually, because I guess I want to make sure people understand that if you're hungry, like I'm hungry right now, I don't think I have low energy availability yet, you know, but when you start really seeing some adaptations, I would assume that's your sign, right? You lose your period. Okay. Now you really do have low energy availability.
Yeah. So it's again, this is kind of like the back to the multifaceted symptom approach, like we did with, talked about with food addiction. So it's like, okay, I'm fatigued, but I'm not fatigued because I had a hard day. I'm fatigued because I've been training a lot and not eating much. You know, I'm sore for longer than I probably should be. My performance is actually not increasing anymore. It's decreasing. I'm losing weight, or I'm like not gaining weight when maybe I want to be or should be. There's also like the hormonal aspect, like you said, your hormones kind of drop off a cliff and stay down. That's your thyroid, T3, T4, estrogen, testosterone, IGF, your growth hormone drops a bit. So all of these things are just kind of slowly tanking, and not coming back up. Now, when you ask about, okay, so now let's say, all right, I have LEA. What do I do? Is it reversible quickly? Well, it's kind of like a almost like a reverse diet used to be, where let me turn my training dial back a little bit. Let me increase my food. And yes, some of those things will happen, but you may not, you may still be hungry. You may still have fatigue. It may take a couple weeks for you to like rebound out of that. That hasn't been studied at all, really. And the best thing we have is the bodybuilding literature, where people have followed competitors post competition, but they do all kinds of crazy stuff. So it's hard to really understand that. But I would say, all right, I'm a client who has LEA. I've got hormonal out of balance, amenorrhea. My training's really high. I feel like crap. Checked all the blocks. Cool. How do I stop? Well, first thing, I'm gonna cut my training probably like by a third at least, maybe by 50%, if I really want to get out of this problem that I'm causing myself. Then I'm probably increasing my calories probably 20 or 30% too, just to get back out of it. And then I can figure out, all right, my body is back to normal. Let me figure out where my maintenance is with all of this training.
I think the other thing that we have to consider is that textbook, that makes sense and sounds good, but usually what gets people into this state is the fact that they're very stubborn and they like to train too much. They probably want to stay really lean, so that's what's pulling them into dieting, even if it's staying lean for their sport. Sometimes there's people who want to stay really lean for their sport, and their sport doesn't even need for them to be lean. You know what I mean? Like, it's just maybe it caused them to get lean and they don't want to reverse that. But, and then you go, okay, now I'm going to go through a reverse diet, but they're not adhering to it properly because they say they're going to cut their training back, but they don't. And so it doesn't always as quick as it should be. But it is nice to know, like, on paper, like, hey, you could do it within, because even like, you know, over the course of, you know, 2, 4, 6 weeks even, isn't that crazy if you think about it? And you hear a lot of people talk about reverse dieting and stuff. Like, you can get it done that if you're just diligent and actually follow the protocol. One question I would have is around amenorrhea. I think it's obvious, you know, with there's so many people anecdotally and even in case studies and science and stuff, female bodybuilders who lose their period. It's almost like expected, like when you get that shred, especially if you're in figure or physique or bodybuilding versus bikini. But there's also been cases where even we as coaching company have seen women lose their period and they're not nearly as shredded as somebody who's on stage. Sometimes they're pretty dang lean and sometimes they're leaner, but they're not shredded. So are there certain people who are more susceptible to amenorrhea and some of these other adaptations from lower calories or even body fat stores? So maybe genetically speaking, some people hormonally just need more body fat on their body or hormonally need more calories coming in to support their menstrual cycle and such.
Yeah, I think so. And again, there's no research here, so I'll kind of speculate a bit. If you look at people and how they truly sit, and these, we work with clients who are like super adherent and they'll follow directions to a T. And you look at them and you're like, you know, on average, you're like right above or below where you should be with having these issues. Why is that? Is it something genetic? Maybe there's some component of it. We, you know, at some point you say, all right, if you're telling me the whole truth, great. What do I do? Like, are you just different? Are you weird? Well, no. People are just different between each other. The nice part about coaching sometimes is you just see a lot of the same thing, so you know how to adapt to it or change, or you have tools in your toolbox, is what I tell the coaches. So I guess to answer your question, yes, there is some component of body fat genetics, but we don't really know what exactly it is right now.
Okay. Yeah, I think Greg Nuckels had a good article recently. He's talking about how metabolic rate and maintenance calorie intake and stuff like that can be impacted by genetics. Like, it's not as simple as some people, like the whole thing of like, yeah, there's not just like, oh, you have a fast metabolism, you use a slow. That's not how it works. Well, actually, to a degree, it actually can work like that a little bit because there can be two, you know, on paper exactly the same people, but one has a higher metabolic rate for no other reason but genetically speaking, that's just how it is. So, that makes a lot of sense. And I think it's the thing I want to kind of just wrap up with that I think will encapsulate both of these. And I'm going to make a statement, and I would love for you to give your context on it, because I think that you are far more conservative with your answers and not nearly as black and white, because you're a scientist, and so you have to be. But I'm not afraid to like throw out some statements and just see if it sticks, so to speak. I think both of these topics are really refreshing to talk about, and I think it's good because although both of them are very serious and there might be some people listening that are going through both of them or working with a client going through both of them, they're very real. However, I also think that both of them can, people can self-diagnose themselves with both of these things prematurely. So they can get fearful of being food addicted or having eating disorders. And look, there's disordered eating and there's eating disorders. Disordered eating is, to an extent, what I'm doing right now. I'm competitively starving myself. Like, that's probably not a normal way to eat. And if I were to continue some of those things or I let them emotionally control me, then it would become a disordered eating. It's not because I'm very intentional about it. It's not upsetting me. It's controlled, right? Last time I prepped, there was absolutely some disordered eating involved because I was very uneducated on what I was doing, how I was doing it, what flexible dieting was, because it wasn't really a thing yet. It was in 2014. It was a long time ago. But my point is that I think that there's a lot of people who jump to the most extreme thing. Like, you probably don't have a food addiction. You probably have some binge episodes because you deprive yourself, and you don't need to deprive yourself like that. You probably haven't been educated properly on nutrition or flexible dieting, whatever it may be. Now, if you're obese and you literally have food stashed everywhere and you can't stop snacking and grazing, then yeah, you might have this issue and you want to go see somebody. But I think there's a lot of people that have jumped to that conclusion. And I think it's the same thing with low energy availability. There's people who will jump to conclusions and think like, I need to start reverse dieting because I have low energy availability. And you look at them, you're like, well, you really don't train that much. Maybe you go to the gym and lift 3-4 days a week. You maybe do a little bit of cardio, high step count, whatever it is, but you're not a track athlete doing 2 days, 7 days a week. And you're dieting, but based on your body weight and all these other factors, that's just part of it. Like, sometimes you have to drop your calories kind of low, lower than we would want. Like, you know, it's the reality. And I've gone through diets where I've had to lower my calories lower than I want. You know, it's a fact. And it also depends on your cardio. Like, right now, my calories are higher than I expect them to be, but I'm also doing way more cardio than I've done in a long time. So it's like, you know, which one's worse? I don't know. It's the same thing. It makes me feel just as hungry as I would be on 1500 calories, even though I'm eating almost 2500 calories, but I'm doing a lot of cardio. So I say all this to say that I think a lot of people jump to conclusions and maybe self-diagnose themselves or get into kind of like a hypochondriac kind of state. And this provided a lot of really good context to show the severity of it, but also to weed out people who are like, okay, maybe I don't have that. Something's going on. I got to like get some control and get some education going on and figure this out. But I don't have low energy availability and I don't have food addiction. You know, does that make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think just to add to that, I think we covered some cool stuff. It's okay to like not know and have to figure it out. Right. Yeah. Like that's why coaches exist. That's why all this educational content exists, is that you come in and you're like, I think I have this problem. So maybe let's say it's LEA or food addiction, or, you know, your metabolism is slow, whatever it is. We and other coaches can walk you through the basic steps to say, all right, you're not losing weight when other people would normally lose weight. Now let's dive a little deeper. Let's get some blood work. Let's go see someone to see if you have some behavioral issues with food. And that's like, it's okay. It's part of the process of figuring out and learning, is just accepting you don't know what you don't know. So hopefully this kind of sheds some light on two different areas that we don't normally cover, because that we do see this in our clients.
100%. Yeah, no, I think it's great topics. I'm glad we did. And next time we have Brandon on, we will cover collagen and creatine. And maybe by then we'll sneak a couple other supplements in there. Who knows? Because there's always stuff coming out on supplements. So I'm going to drop a few different links in the description of this podcast, guys. First one being Brandon's Instagram handle. Mine will be there as well. So make sure you share this podcast on your Instagram story if you enjoyed it, and you can tag us so we can thank you for listening. Share this with a friend. Leave a 5-star rating review. You know the whole deal. And then head over to tailoredcoachingmethod.com because we have a lot of content coming out all the time. And Brandon has written many research reviews, many articles. So if you like this science-based kind of content, that is the place to go. As always, guys, we appreciate you, and we will catch you next time.